So in 2025, if an NYPD officer decided to, search you on their own initiative,
Like just out of nowhere.
yeah, exactly,
Yeah.
they were legally justified only 60% of the time.
Which is a pretty wild statistic when you actually stop and think about it.
Right, think about that for a second. That means 40% of the time, those self-initiated searches were, well, either questionable or just outright unlawful. And that's according to data from the Floyd Monitor.
Yeah. And now imagine throwing explicit intentional racism into that 40% margin of error.
Exactly. Because we are talking about subconscious bias today. Welcome to today's deep dive. We're looking at a deeply reported analysis published on April 4th, 2026, by Eric Sanders.
Right. He's a retired NYPD officer turned civil rights attorney.
Yep. And his piece is titled "White Supremacist Infiltration is a Public Safety Threat." It focuses on some highly disturbing allegations coming out of the Patrol Bureau Manhattan North Narcotics Unit.
And just to be clear for you listening, our job today isn't to like take a political stance on any of this.
Right. No, absolutely not.
We're looking strictly at the operational math and the legal frameworks that Sanders lays out, because his core argument is that explicit racist conduct inside a police command isn't just a bad PR day.
Or like a toxic HR issue.
Exactly. It's an existential threat to investigative integrity, confidential intelligence, and really the legal system itself.
Yeah, and if we agree that contaminating the system is a catastrophe, we have to look at the specific poison being introduced here. Okay, let's unpack this.
It's heavy stuff.
It is. Sanders focuses on a digital group chat that reportedly included about 18 officers, detectives, and supervisors from that Manhattan North Narcotics Unit.
18 people. That's not a small chat.
No, it's really not. And the allegations claim a white detective circulated an image of himself wearing a Ku Klux Klan uniform inside a department facility.
Wow.
Yeah. And the chat also allegedly contained an AI-generated image of a white officer dragging black monkeys near NYPD headquarters, along with comments explicitly invoking lynching and extermination.
Like what kind of comments?
Specifically phrases like, "hang Mexicans and gas Jews."
I mean, it's a staggering level of explicit hostility, and it really forces a very uncomfortable conversation about institutional vulnerability.
It does. But let me play devil's advocate for a second here.
Sure.
Just to understand the typical bureaucratic response that Sanders is critiquing.
Yeah.
If you're sitting in a city's legal department or, an HR office, you might say, "Look, this is abhorrent."
Right, these are terrible people.
Exactly. These are terrible people with incredibly offensive taste in a private chat. We fire them and it's over.
The bad apple argument.
Right. So why does Sanders elevate this from a toxic workplace issue to a massive public safety crisis? I mean, if someone brings a toxic chemical into an ordinary office building, it's a hazard. You clean it up, you fire the person, the company survives. But if they bring that same chemical into a city's water treatment plant,
It contaminates the drinking water for millions of people.
exactly, contaminates the whole city.
Well, what's fascinating here is that the water treatment plant analogy is actually the perfect lens for this.
How so?
Because police institutions aren't standard corporate offices, and a narcotics command is arguably the most sensitive filtration point in the entire justice system.
Right.
Narcotics policing isn't administrative work where a crime has already happened and an officer arrives to just take notes and collect video.
They aren't just taking reports.
No, the entire job relies heavily on secrecy,
Huh?
unrecorded judgments, and just immense immediate officer discretion.
Because they're making split-second decisions based on their own observations, like who looks suspicious on this corner.
Right. Whose car do we pull over? Which pocket do we search?
Exactly.
Precisely the point. The work lives almost entirely in the zone of self-initiated activity. So when you take an environment that already struggles with lawful discretion, like that 60% compliance rate you mentioned at the start,
Yeah, the huge margin of error.
right, and you inject literal Klan imagery and exterminatory rhetoric into it, that bias completely corrupts the foundational intelligence.
It dictates target selection.
Exactly. It skews surveillance priorities, and crucially, it creates a profoundly dangerous situation for confidential informants.
Oh, wow. Yeah, informants are incredibly vulnerable to begin
I
with.
completely.
I mean, they're often trading information for leniency, and they usually come from the exact same marginalized communities that are being targeted by the hate speech in that group chat.
Right, and a narcotics unit simply cannot function without confidential sources buying drugs, wearing wires, and introducing undercover officers to syndicates.
It's the lifeblood of the unit.
It is. So if a command is permeated by explicit racist conduct, the operational security of those sources just evaporates.
Because the officers handling them might not even view them as fully human.
Exactly. You're placing informants in extreme physical danger. Think about it. If an officer's private group chat jokes about lynching, how motivated is that officer to ensure the physical safety of a Black or Hispanic informant during a high-risk buy-and-bust operation?
That is terrifying.
Yeah.
And if the very foundation of narcotics work, like the intelligence gathering, the discretion, the handling of sources, is thoroughly compromised by this level of explicit bias at the intelligence stage, you have to ask, who saw this coming?
Well, they did see it coming.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Law enforcement has been warned about this exact threat model for decades. Sanders anchors his analysis on a 2006 FBI intelligence assessment.
2006? It's almost 20 years ago.
Yep. Nearly 20 years ago, the federal government explicitly warned that white supremacist infiltration or sympathy within law enforcement threatens intelligence collection.
They put that in writing.
They did. The FBI stated unequivocally that this kind of presence breaches investigations, endangers sources, and inevitably leads to abuses of authority.
It's just wild to me that the FBI put that in writing in 2006, yet we're still pretending these are isolated incidents in 2026.
I know.
And Sanders makes a really sharp distinction here between implicit bias and explicit bias. He pulls from a Brennan Center report called Hidden in Plain Sight.
Right, which is a great report.
Yeah, because we hear so much about implicit bias, right? Like the subconscious prejudices that departments try to train away with seminars.
Mm-hmm.
But Sanders is targeting explicit racism. AI generating an image of racial terror isn't a subconscious microaggression.
No, not at all.
It's an intentional, deliberate act of creation. So if the FBI warned about this in 2006, why does the Brennan Center say explicit racism is still often handled with, like, internal tolerance until a scandal forces the issue?
Well, the Brennan Center report argues that the intense focus on implicit bias reform has actually kind of provided cover for explicit racism.
Oh, interesting.
Because explicit racism isn't just card-carrying membership in a known extremist group anymore. It includes racist digital conduct and overt discriminatory behavior toward the public. And the problem is that institutions often treat explicit racism with what Sanders calls passive tolerance.
Ah, yes, passive tolerance. Because, you know, a vague weekend PowerPoint presentation on diversity is historically the best way to cure someone of circulating Klan photos, right?
Right. It's an absurd institutional reflex.
Okay.
But look at the mechanics of the Manhattan North narcotics allegations.
Okay.
This wasn't just one rogue officer on a burner phone. It was an 18-person chat that reportedly included supervisors.
Supervisors were in the chat.
Yes. And when a supervisor sits in a chat like that and says nothing, the silence is an endorsement.
Wow. Yeah, they're normalizing it.
Exactly. They are establishing the baseline reality for that command. They're signaling that racial contempt is a perfectly acceptable operational culture.
And the text points out the chilling effect that it has on everyone else in the building. I mean, if you're a good cop in that unit and your sergeant is laughing at a meme about gassing Jews, you're terrified to report it.
Of course you are.
Fear of retaliation keeps the whistleblowers quiet. And so the internal check and balance system just collapses.
Totally.
The unit basically becomes a walled garden for abuses of authority.
Which brings us to the inevitable breaking point. Because the intelligence gathered in that contaminated environment doesn't just stay in the station house.
Right. It eventually has to leave the building.
It has to be used to prosecute people.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because the poisoned well eventually hits a judge's desk. And Sanders introduces two massive legal precedents that blow these kinds of cases wide open.
Brady and Giglio.
Exactly. Brady and Giglio. These are the disclosure rules that essentially say prosecutors cannot hide a police officer's bad track record from the defense.
Right.
If an officer has a history of lying or, you know, documented bias, the defense has a constitutional right to know about it.
And taking that further, think about how those rules apply specifically to a narcotics case.
Okay, lay it out for us.
Unlike a bank robbery, where you have, say, multiple civilian witnesses and high-definition security footage.
Right, hard evidence.
Exactly. A drug arrest often rests entirely on an officer's sworn narrative. The prosecutor, the judge, and the jury are relying completely on that officer's testimony to establish probable cause.
So if the officer, who is the sole narrator of the facts, is sitting in a KKK group chat, it's not just a character flaw.
No.
It's a structural weakness in the state's evidence. It's like finding out the load-bearing wall of a skyscraper is made of rotted wood. You can't just paint over it and hope the building stands.
That's a great way to put it. And the defense counsel is legally entitled to inspect that load-bearing wall.
Under Brady and Giglio.
Right. They can argue in court that the officer's interpretation of events, their decision to escalate a stop, and their selection of who to target were all infected by explicit racial bias.
Because their neutrality is completely compromised.
Exactly. The officer's credibility is the only thing holding the conviction together. Under these obligations, the prosecutor is legally barred from hiding that rot from the defense.
And Sanders brings up a devastating historical example of what happens when that credibility collapses. The Joseph Franco scandal?
Oh, yeah. That was massive.
It was huge. Franco was an undercover NYPD narcotics detective whose sworn narratives were proven false. And the fallout wasn't just Franco losing his job.
No, it was so much worse.
The legal system had to unravel and dismiss over 500 cases across New York. It cost the city over $1.7 million in settlements.
500 cases.
500. It's like a collapsing house of cards. It's not just one bad hand. The whole deck is marked. Every single case that officer touched had to be thrown out. But this raises a practical question for me.
What's that?
How exactly does immediately notifying a prosecutor actually protect the legal system from these biased claims? I mean, if the officer is biased, isn't the case ruined anyway?
Well, it's about triage.
Triage.
Yeah. Immediate notification is the only way to manage the legal risk before the damage multiplies. If an internal affairs unit discovers this group chat and immediately hands it over to the district attorney, the prosecutors can evaluate their Brady and Giglio obligations up front.
Oh, I see. So they can look at the cases currently on the docket.
Exactly. They can decide whether they can ethically proceed with pending cases, or if they have enough corroborating evidence like wiretaps or other independent witnesses to win without relying on the compromised officer's testimony.
So they stop the bleeding before it infects hundreds of other convictions.
Yes. Hiding the bias is what destroys cases. If you disclose it early, you might lose a few cases, but you preserve the integrity of the overall system.
Makes sense.
If you hide it and it leaks out years later through a lawsuit or a whistleblower, you experience full evidentiary collapse. The courts are forced to mass dismiss years of convictions because the entire judicial process was structurally unfair.
Wow. So transparency and immediate disclosure are literally the only legal mechanisms that prevent the justice system from eating itself alive.
Pretty much.
But if disclosure is the only logical move, how do police departments historically handle these scandals when they break? Do they rush to the DA's office with the group chat printouts?
Historically, the instinct is the exact opposite.
Shocking.
Right. Sanders observes that the standard bureaucratic reflex is quiet containment.
Quiet containment. That sounds like moving the problem around instead of solving it.
Exactly. Transferring officers to a different borough, pushing them into early retirement, or just putting them on desk duty while waiting for the news cycle to die down.
Right. Hoping people forget.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, Sanders walks through a brutally long history of the NYPD attempting this exact shell game with catastrophic results.
Like what?
Well, he points to the 113th precinct in Queens during the 1980s. Officers were accused of using stun guns on suspects to force confessions.
Oh my.
Yeah. And instead of aggressively rooting out the core instigators, the department just transferred massive numbers of personnel around. The underlying culture wasn't dismantled, it was just relocated.
Wow. He also mentions the Dirty 30 corruption scandal in Harlem during the 90s, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Mullen Commission that investigated it. That seems like a perfect example of what happens when quiet containment completely fails.
It really is. The Mullen Commission's findings are vital to understanding this. They discovered that the culture of the 30th Precinct wasn't just about a few officers turning a blind eye to minor rule breaking.
Right.
The culture actively demanded participation in corruption to prove you were loyal to the badge. Officers were functioning like armed robbers, literally breaking into apartments to steal drugs and cash.
That is insane.
And it happened because supervisors practiced passive tolerance of minor infractions, which created an environment where massive criminality felt entirely safe from scrutiny.
It's a progression. The text even traces this escalation to the Abner Louima case in 1997, which, you know, remains one of the darkest chapters in American policing.
Absolutely. The Louima case is the ultimate endpoint of passive tolerance. Louima was brutally assaulted and tortured inside a precinct bathroom.
Yeah.
And Sanders connects this to the group chat allegations by pointing out that when internal degradation is tolerated, when officers are allowed to strip away the humanity of the people they police, whether through jokes, slurs, or AI images, the moral boundaries inside that station house completely evaporate.
Because they stop seeing them as people.
Exactly. And it inevitably spills out onto the street as horrific physical violence because the officers believe they are immune to consequences.
And lest anyone listening think this is just 1990s history, Sanders pulls this right into the present day.
He does.
He cites the Yates Report, which analyzed NYPD discipline post-Floyd litigation. It shows that even today, when officers commit documented constitutional violations, they frequently receive incredibly soft command discipline.
Right.
We're talking about a stern talking to or quote-unquote retraining instead of actual accountability.
Which is so damaging because the institution inadvertently teaches its officers that grave misconduct is survivable.
Yeah, just keep your head down.
Exactly. Keep your head down, accept the minor reprimand, and you'll be back on the street. Meanwhile, the damage inflicted on the community is permanent.
And that's the crux of it, right?
Yeah.
Because policing doesn't function in a vacuum. It relies entirely on civilian cooperation.
100%.
Detectives need witnesses to come forward. They need victims to report crimes. But if a target community knows that the officers patrolling their block are trading Klan imagery and laughing about lynching on their phones, they rightfully realize they are caught in a devastating double bind.
They realize they are simultaneously over-targeted as suspects and under-protected as victims.
Man, imagine calling the police because your home has been broken into or someone you love is in danger, and you have to wonder if the officer who shows up even views you as a human being. The psychological toll of that is just immeasurable.
It is. And operationally, once that trust is gone, public safety collapses in both directions.
Yeah.
Witnesses refuse to testify, crimes go unsolved, and the entire civic premise of law enforcement just breaks down. A police department cannot protect a neighborhood that is terrified of the police.
So what does this all mean? When you lay all of this out, the federal warnings from 20 years ago, the legal time bombs created by Brady and Giglio obligations, and the brutal historical failures of trying to quietly contain these scandals, it becomes undeniable that business as usual is impossible here.
Completely impossible.
If the Manhattan North narcotics allegations are true, that unit is functionally paralyzed. Their primary product isn't paperwork or arrest quotas. Their primary product is credibility.
Mm-hmm.
It is the moral and legal authority to wield state power. If the public, the defense attorneys, the prosecutors, and the judges cannot trust their credibility, they have absolutely no authority left to exercise.
And Sanders concludes exactly that. Explicit bias isn't a workplace quirk. It is fundamentally a question of fitness to exercise state power.
So let's summarize the key takeaways for you listening, because this is a dense, incredibly important topic. First, explicit racist conduct in a police unit, especially a highly discretionary unit like narcotics, isn't just deeply offensive. It is a structural public safety threat that destroys confidential intelligence and puts informants in direct physical danger.
Right.
Second, it creates a massive legal vulnerability. Tainted officer credibility forces mass case dismissals because prosecutors cannot legally hide an officer's bias from defense attorneys under Brady and Giglio precedents. Immediate notification is the only way to triage that damage.
Exactly.
And third, these actions shatter the community cooperation required to actually solve crimes. You cannot police a city that you hold in explicit contempt.
Which leaves us with a deeply unsettling final thought to mull over.
Oh, what's that?
Well, we've spent this time focusing on the legal and operational collapse that happens when one specific group chat leaks, right? Like in this Manhattan North narcotics case.
Yep.
But consider the scale of modern digital communication. If a single AI image and a handful of slurs in one digital chat can legally dismantle hundreds of criminal convictions due to Brady obligations.
Oh, man.
How many currently incarcerated people might be freed tomorrow if the encrypted group chats of every major police precinct in the country were suddenly subpoenaed?
Wow. That is a staggering question to walk away with. We just assume the machinery of state power is structurally sound. But if we were to open the casing and inspect every single load-bearing beam, how much of the system would have to be condemned?
It makes you wonder.
It really does. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the systems around you. Keep demanding clarity on how power operates, and we'll catch you next time.